15 years ago, I was in Taiwan auditing one of our international subsidiaries. I went with a couple colleagues, one of whom happened to be from Taiwan. Her name was Shu Wah. And Kristen was able to come with me, as this was before kids. Over the weekend, Shu Wah took me and Kristen to a Buddhist temple in Taipei called the Lungshan Temple of Man Ka. And I stood in the courtyard in the midst of buildings with terracotta pagoda-style roofs with the flared ends and pillars sculpted with dragons and rooster lanterns hung from the eaves, as this was during Chinese New Year. Gold ornamentation, dragons and warriors on horseback. Traditional Chinese characters decorated the walls. Nothing was in English, and I didn't see any other Westerners there. I observed from a distance. I didn't want to act inappropriately. People had incense sticks held in front of them, and they bowed and nodded their heads a few times. It appeared they were saying prayers. And then they'd stick the incense into a large gold cauldron, and fragrant smoke rose from a big pot with a cover held up by human figures. They'd reach a hand into the cauldron and scoop out smoke, I imagined, as some fragrant offering to a god. Shu Wah must have noticed my reluctance to get too close. "You can burn incense if you want," she told me. "No, that's okay." I didn't explain to her that I was a Christian. It didn't seem appropriate at the time, being on her sacred ground. "I'll just watch you," I said. "Oh, I'm not Buddhist," she said. "I'm a Christian." "What? Kristen and I are Christians too." I asked if she became a Christian when she moved to America. "No, I became one here. My parents sent me to a private English-speaking school, and it was run by Christians." She walked us through the temple, explaining the various traditions. The prayers were being offered to the goddess of mercy, Guanyin, sea goddess, Matsu, and a god of war, Guan Yu. The temple was used to pray to other gods, or even for the veneration of the dead. She explained that ancestry worship was part of her family culture. It hurt her father and mother when she became a Christian because they felt like she was disrespecting her ancestors. Inside the temple, people brought food offerings to their gods or deceased relatives. Fresh fruit, boxes of crackers, cookies, anything that the gods or dead relatives didn't eat was eaten by the temple priests and staff. It all seemed so strange, but familiar. I can imagine how Christian traditions look to outsiders. Kristen and I like to invite people to our holiday dinners. Some of the people we've invited were not Christians, and they would have seen us pray. Imagine what would be going through the mind of a tech professor or researcher from China who had never met a Christian before moving to America, who had little exposure to American culture, at least not American culture within a Christian home. Someone who doesn't believe there to be any world beyond his five senses. Someone who doesn't believe in a spiritual world. What would this man think as we thanked God for our food, for the blessings of the year, for sending his son? After one Thanksgiving, a Chinese man who had recently arrived in America said that he was surprised because he always thought of America as a technologically advanced country that believes in science. Yet there were so many Christians. Maybe you're familiar enough with Christian traditions where a prayer over dinner wouldn't seem odd, but you don't understand all of the practices. And I can imagine a number of our traditions are weird. And on the surface, they might look like traditions of many other religions. People see just what is on the surface. Hallmarks of religious phenomenology. Some sort of unique vocabulary and language. Some source of knowledge by special revelation. Some moral code of what's right and what is wrong. Some people think all religions are fundamentally the same in having a moral code wrapped up in superstitious nonsense. They're just superficially different. And that Hindus pray to many gods, Christians pray to a god with a capital G, Jews pray to the same god, some don't write the name, they just write G-D. Muslims pray five times toward Mecca to a god they call Allah. And since they say he is the only god, some assume that he's the same god as the Jews and the Christians. But the Christians also say that Jesus is God and a man, and there's a spirit that make up the triune God. Now that's starting to look a little bit like the many Hindu gods. The people who think that all these religions are fundamentally the same, just superficially different, they got that completely backward. The religions are fundamentally different. They're just superficially the same. Every religion is an attempt to bridge the gap between God and us, the seen and the unseen, the temporal and the eternal, even Christianity. But the Christian God is fundamentally different in that Yahweh, the God of the Jews, the God of Israel, the God of the Christians, reached out to us. He provided a way to bridge a gap between him and us. That way was Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through him. But is Christianity too exclusive? In an increasingly inclusive world, is Christianity too narrow? That is the question of the day. My quick response is no. Christianity is radically inclusive. Everybody is invited. Everybody is welcome. The gate is narrow, as Jesus said, only in the sense that most people will choose to go their own way. But the answer doesn't really get to what people are actually asking. People are saying something much deeper. Let's watch this video.
I think I'd be ignorant to say that Christianity is the only right religion. I don't know what the right religion is. It's just what I believe it is.
Some people that I've met, it's just I've had friends, and the minute they find out about me, or the minute that I do anything that doesn't follow their religion, they don't want anything to do with me.
There's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad that can come out of it. And I'm not sure if it's from religion that the bad or the good comes out of it, or whether it's the people.
I respect a lot of faiths, and I think that Christianity is the pillar that's influenced by the other great religions in the world.
La cristianidad es muy importante porque podemos aprender valores cristianos donde no podemos, donde descubrimos más acerca de nosotros.
My view on anyone who claims to have a monopoly on truth is that there's no one truth about anything. I think that a lot of religions say the same thing in different ways.
One quote. I think I would be ignorant to say that Christianity is the only right religion. I don't know what the right religion is. It's just what I believe it is. Another quote. My view on anyone who claims to have a monopoly on the truth is that there is no truth about anything. I think a lot of religions say the same thing in different ways. They're asking, how could Christianity make an exclusive claim to the truth when there is no way we could possibly know anything about the metaphysical world? In fairness, I think people would ask the same thing of a devout Muslim or someone who truly believes in the Hindu gods. Every religion makes exclusive claims, or at least rejects the claims of other religions. Logically, two contradictory propositions cannot both be true. If Christianity says there is one God, and Hindus say there are many, one is true and one is not. Or neither is true, but there is a truth. And for centuries, the debate was over which faith was true. Was Christianity true, or Islam, or Hinduism? But the modernist philosophers rejected the idea that any truth could be known of the metaphysical world. We can only know what we observe through our five senses. And any truth beyond what we can see, touch, hear, feel, or taste are great meta-narratives, either propagated by those in power or used by the oppressed to justify their miserable existence. So modernists like Karl Marx and Charles Darwin introduced new godless meta-narratives. And these guys were not so much an economist and scientist, respectively, but they were philosophers who attempted to explain origin, purpose, and morality. And this is what caused Nietzsche to exclaim, "God is dead, he remains dead, and we have killed him." He meant it in a cultural sense. Nietzsche actually believed in God. But speaking of the culture, God was no longer central in the minds of people. But to say there is no God is a bridge too far for most people. About 89% of Americans still believe there is a God. About half of Americans believe that God is the God as described in the Bible. And about a third of Americans believe in some unidentified higher power or spiritual force. And those people today I especially want to address. I say we can know the truth. And I hope you wouldn't dismiss out of hand the idea of the one true faith in the Christian God through Jesus Christ because you've been influenced by our culture. Carl Jung said, "People don't have ideas. Ideas have people." And an idea that many people have today, it's called postmodernism. Some of the worst ideas of the modernist philosophers were picked up by the postmodernists of the 1950s through the 80s and brought to their most illogical conclusions. As difficult as it is to put modernism into a box, postmodernism is even more varied and incoherent. Nonetheless, the highlights include deconstructionism in the rejection of absolute truths. Paul Feyerabend said, "The only absolute truth is that there is no absolute truth." Jacques Derrida described the death of the author and proposed that text should be read and interpreted in the eyes of the reader. It's no longer what the author meant, but what the passage means to the reader. It's no longer what the speaker meant, but whether or not you're offended. This deconstructionist view leads people to say things like, "That's your truth. This is my truth." And that's because pleasure is elevated to the highest goal in life. And the truth is whatever brings you pleasure. It's no longer about which religion is true, but which brings you happiness. Michel Foucault, a dude, French dude, took the modernist view of questioning meta-narratives to the extreme of proposing that truth is socially constructed. His words, socially constructed. Think of what else today is now considered to be socially constructed. And truth claims are disguised claims to power. Knowledge is power, and any text is written by someone who is attempting to exert power. So he supposed that you can find truth in whichever power you wish to align yourself. Deconstructionism ends up being an open invitation to cynicism. Most people can't live as a postmodernist. Their philosophies are too incoherent. Believe me, I spent a month studying this stuff. It's painful. Nonetheless, postmodernist philosophers give words to the ideas that shape our culture through those who make movies, write books, and report news. Modernist philosophy plays out in the media through irony, cynicism, and irreverence. Think of how comedy has changed from slapstick to observations of human behavior to critiquing our institutions and society. It's become cynical and irreverent. Think of how late-night comics rely on criticizing politicians, making them all out to look corrupt rather than people who want to serve our country. Maybe they have bad ideas, but I believe most want to serve our country. Think of how sitcoms have changed from stories with noble characters that show some moral lesson to social satires. The sitcom dads of the 70s were competent, wise, and caring. But more and more shows portray the dad to be an idiot. Think of the moral relativism in shows like Breaking Bad. I'm not talking absolutes here. Of course, there were cynical shows in the 1970s, and there are hopeful shows today. I'm painting in broad strokes to make the point that culture influences the way we think, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Irony can be an effective tool to shape culture. For example, in the 70s, there was a show called Archie Bunker, in which Carol O'Connor, Carol is a dude, back when Carol was a guy's name. Women are taking all the good names, like seriously. Kyle, like a friend of mine has a daughter named Kyle. I mean, it's like, dude, we're running out of names. Like, seriously. But anyhow, people love to hate Archie Bunker. The character gave people someone to mock and ridicule, thereby teaching them that racism is bad. So even the irony of Archie Bunker had some morality behind it. But then in the 1990s, we had shows like Seinfeld, the show about nothing. It's a hilarious show, but at its root, it mocks everything. Again, funny stuff, but think of the subtle lessons we learn from episodes like Festivus. George Costanza's father didn't identify with any religion, so he made up his own holiday, Festivus for the rest of us. Was celebrated on December 23 with a plain, unadorned Festivus pole, Festivus dinner, the airing of grievances, and feats of strength. His mother would say, George, fight your father. Funny stuff. But the subtle message is that all religions are the same. If you don't identify with any of the other religions, just make up your own. Please don't send a text message or email saying, I was too hard on Seinfeld. I'm not trying to make you feel guilty for watching it. I watched it too. I'm just pointing out that culture can influence us. But if we're aware of the messages, they become ineffective at changing our minds. And then we can just enjoy the show for what it is. David Foster Wallace said, "Irony, as entertaining as it is, serves an exclusively negative function. It's critical and destructive, a ground clearing. Irony, which is exploiting gaps between what is said and what is meant, between how things try to appear and how things really are, is a time-honored way artists seek to illuminate and expose hypocrisy." I'm still quoting here. "But irony is singularly unuseful when it comes to constructing anything to replace the hypocrisies it debunks." David Foster Wallace is an author. He wrote, Infinite Jest? I think I got through about 4 pages of it. It looked brilliant. Just couldn't read it. He's not a postmodernist, by the way. Postmodernism is good at deconstructing, at tearing things apart. But in the end, it offers no solution. Now, as I said, it's difficult to live as a postmodernist. Even shows that contain postmodernist elements, like The Office with the idiot boss, have redemptive factors of people trying to connect in community, like the love between Jim and Pamela, right? And that's good, that's hopeful. And I highlight all of this to point out that this increasingly inclusive world is in fact increasingly cynical. America has not become a culture with more religions, with more beliefs, but one of less faith in anything. I can't speak to the motivation of all, but I suspect those who say all religions are the same think that the purpose of religion is to bring happiness. I'm not going to talk anybody into becoming a Christian because it will make them happier. That's not the point of Christianity. And the point of Christianity is definitely not to be religious. Jesus did not speak kindly of the religious type. The gospel of Jesus Christ brings hope to a cynical world by recognizing the truth of our origins, of having been created in the image of God, by providing us with a purpose greater than ourselves, an objective moral code, and an understanding of our destiny. Let's look at a story from the Bible as an example of how one of the early church leaders connected with a culture that's not too dissimilar from today. Not long after the death of Jesus, a doctor by the name of Luke recorded the history of the early church in a book called Acts of the Apostles. And even the most secular of historians don't argue the veracity of the early manuscripts being reliable copies of the original book that was written in about 60 AD. Luke tells of a Jewish teacher of the law named Saul who persecuted and executed Christians. Saul was blind to the truth, but he had such zeal that Jesus wanted him on his team. So Jesus blinded him entirely and then showed him the truth. After investigating the claims, Saul realized that he had been wrong. And later when Paul, as Saul called himself when he was traveling outside of Jerusalem, encountered other incredulous people in the Greek city of Berea, he commended them for searching the truth. Then down in Athens, he addressed people who had different religious practices. That story is recorded in Acts 17, starting in verse 16. If you want to follow along with me, the text is on the screen, or you can follow along in the Bibles under the seats in front of you on page 926. The story shows that Paul dealt with the same sort of questions we have today. "Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. The Epicureans were those who followed the philosophies of Epicurus, who taught a materialism. He rejected superstition and divine intervention. Does that sound familiar? He was a modernist philosopher well before the modern day. Epicurus taught that pleasure was the greatest good, and the greatest pleasure is obtained through living modestly, gaining knowledge of the material world, and limiting one's desires. And that sounds a lot like postmodernism, or maybe secular Buddhism. And the Stoics were those who believed the path to happiness is found in focusing on logical consequences to our actions, one's part in the natural order and in society, and not being controlled by our desire for pleasure or our fear of pain. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be preaching of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and they brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. And Paul had that going for him. They were curious enough to give him a hearing. And if you're here trying to figure out what Christianity is about, I commend you for your curiosity. So these philosophers took him to the Areopagus, a prominent rock outcropping in Athens. In Latin, it was called Mars Hill. Well, they probably didn't use the word hill, but you got the idea. And if you've heard of any church called Mars Hill, that's what it's named for, because Paul delivered the sermon there. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, and that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, even as some of your own poets have said. For we are indeed his offspring. See what he did there? He connected and contrasted. He walked through the city, he found an altar with an inscription to the unknown God, and then he connected that to the one true God. And that line, for we are indeed his offspring, is from the Greek poet Aratus, from his poem Phenomena. This guy made observations of the constellations and declared that all things were dependent on Zeus. Paul was quoting from the fifth line of the poem that starts off, let us begin with Zeus, whom we mortals never leave unspoken. For every street, every marketplace is full of Zeus. Even the sea and the harbor are full of this deity. Everywhere, everyone is indebted to Zeus, for we are indeed his offspring. That could almost be spoken by a Jew or Christian if you change the name to Yahweh or God. And Paul acknowledged the Zeus followers had an element of truth. In the same way, we can make a connection to God for people who adhere to other religions. Muslims believe in one God. They're monotheists, and that's a start. And they recognize Jesus as a prophet, his virgin birth, and the historic fact of his death and resurrection. Hindus believe in many gods. Again, an open door to have a conversation with someone who understands that there is a spiritual world. Buddhists have a pretty good grasp of suffering. Okay, Jesus knew a lot about suffering. But we don't want to leave it there with them understanding only part of the picture. It's like the story of the blind man and the elephant. Each blind man feels part of the elephant, but none of them see it in whole. One says it's a wall. Another feels the trunk and says it's a snake. Another feels the leg and says it's a tree. And the blind men are like the various religions of the world, each of them seeing part of the spiritual world beyond us, but they don't see it in whole. And we can help them understand. Paul helped the Zeus followers understand the bigger picture by using reason. In verse 29, being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. We can reason with those who adhere to other religions today. Yes, Muhammad was correct that there is one God, and Jesus spoke on behalf of God. Now let's look at what Jesus said. If what Jesus said is false, then he's a false prophet. If what he said was true, then he's God. Hindus believe in many gods, but there is one God above all gods. Buddhists are partially correct that we should strip ourselves of our desires, but we can't leave it there. We have to fill that void with something. Strip ourselves of the desires of the flesh and replace it with the desire for God. But one might ask, what gives Christians the right to say they have the truth? Aren't we also one of the blind men feeling only part? Yes. Even the Apostle Paul said, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know in full. We don't know the whole picture, but God does. And he himself revealed enough for us to understand our origins and having been created in the image of God, our purpose in reflecting his glory with the moral, objective moral standards and a destiny that accounts for our actions. Back to our text, picking up in verse 30. Finally, Paul ends his sermon with a call to action. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. There's no excuse to go back to the days of ignorance. There's no excuse to dismiss this whole idea of God by saying no truth can be known about the metaphysical world. We have scripture starting from 1500 years before Christ that contains some 1800 prophetic statements that can be verified. We have historic evidence, eyewitness accounts, and the effects of the Spirit of God through Jesus Christ living in the hearts and minds of people. Don't be blinded by your own zeal. Investigate the claims. Use logic. Open your mind and your heart, and you'll find that God is not far off. God provided a way for everyone to have peace. This is profoundly inclusive, not exclusive. This issue of inclusivity can be seen today in our culture. Think of the politically correct culture today, where one transgression years ago can never be forgiven. Where it's not what a person intends, but whether or not the audience is offended. That's not inclusivity. That is a complete lack of grace that just hurts my soul. Christianity is radically inclusive through the grace and forgiveness of Jesus Christ. Following Jesus is different from every other faith on earth in that he sacrificed to get to us rather than us sacrificing to get to him. Most religions boil down to humanity trying to reach God, but Christianity is God reaching humanity. I hope the world will not see us as being narrow-minded, but as reflecting the character of God and being the most welcoming, loving, and inclusive people they know. Father, thank you so much for your word, for the guidance that it gives us, the guidance that Jesus gives us. Pray that we're a community of people so loving that the world cannot ignore it. Pray that we'll be bombarded with questions about why we do the things we do and believe what we believe. And pray that we have the faith, the courage, the gentleness, and the respect to share our faith boldly and humbly. In Jesus' name, amen.